Wake up. It's the Sleep Unplugged podcast with Dr. Chris Winner, episode 51. Dispatches from the 2023 Sleep Scientific Meeting, new sensation. Welcome everyone to the show. My name is Chris Winner. I'm a neurologist and sleep specialist and your host. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. If you are a veteran of the podcast, welcome back. This is going to be a fun episode that we will try to do every year in and around the time of the big scientific sleep meeting in my community where everybody comes with their amazing research and presents. This year it was in Indianapolis. I was fortunate enough to attend. I generally do. It's a great meeting full of great people who really care about the science of sleep and rigorously studying it. So it was really fun to be there and see a lot of friends and buddies and see the great research that is coming out from that meeting. So we're going to add this to our list of special episodes. We do our holiday gift giving guide. We do the year-end Sleep Unplugged Awards. And now we can do the scientific sleep meeting episode as one of those episodes. Before we get started, I just wanted to mention very quickly in the last episode, we were talking a lot about sort of sleeping pills, and it all kind of came from a conversation I had with a sleep colleague, and I made a mistake. We always start the show off with corrections, comments, criticisms, and the mistake that I made was referring to her practice location now as being Alabama. She actually practices out of Charlotte. And we are, of course, talking about our good buddy, Nicole Mims. You can follow her on Twitter. And something else I didn't know about Nicole is that she is the author of a book called Power Switch Parenting, How to Avoid Parent Burnout. And I think that's awesome. And I think who better to write the How to Avoid Parent Burnout book than somebody who's deeply interested in the science and research of sleep. So everybody needs to check that book out. Sorry about mangling where you're from, Nicole. Really happy you're a part of our podcast family. And I'm going to go ahead and move forward to our communication, which I think dovetails very nicely in terms of what we're talking about today, which sort of lends itself to some of the research that was coming out. So we were talking about sleeping pills in episode 50. Is there a case for them? And I got a tweet. It's a public tweet, but I'm still not going to mention this individual's name. And it basically said, have you ever had a patient who you've done all this for? You've given the book. You've led them to your podcast. You've led them to other people's amazing books about CBTI. They faithfully do everything, but they still find they require medication in order to get enough quality sleep to keep their job and have at least a minimum quality of life. And this was hashtag Larium residue, which is a Larium is a anti-malarial drug. Mefloquine, I believe is the other name for it. You can tell I'm not a infectious disease doctor, but there has been studies that show that individuals, and I'm aware of, I think there was a veteran study that looked at individuals who were exposed to this medication, and they had something, you know, they had a lot of sleep complaints, you know, 15% or so range complaints of insomnia. And those are very difficult studies to look at because of, you know, when you're doing military studies and whatnot. I'm not aware of any study showing that this medication prevents sleep, but I'm certain that it can affect it. And again, you're not talking to an expert about that kind of thing. So we're kind of back to a common individual that we see, which is, I hear what you're doing. I'm putting it all out there, but don't you think there could be exceptions maybe with somebody who's been exposed to a medication in which you need the medication in order to live a functional life? So there's two parts to that question. I'm not going to be able to answer either one of them. Is there evidence that shows that, you know, exposure to certain chemicals like this could decimate sleep to the point where that individual is functionally incapacitated. I'm not aware of that research. You know, I actually was walking around Indianapolis looking for that research, looking for that. I've always thought that'd be a great study to have individuals like this and other people who are just beyond in terms of their complaints and their frustrations, like creating a cohort of those individuals and really studying them, like bring them into a lab and study them for a month. How does their sleep compare to the sleep of normal individuals, the sleep of individuals who have not been exposed to these kinds of medications? I think that's fantastic. You know, that would be fascinating. So that's part one. Part two is, let's assume these people exist, which, again, I've never seen evidence that they do. The population of people who have had X happen to them and now they can't sleep, with the exception of something like maybe familial fatal insomnia, which is, as the name implies, fatal. Then it becomes, okay, well, you do have a population of these people. What sleeping pills or medications out there are able to restore inadequate or absent sleep, causing basically personal ruin, to a place where an individual would be able to function fairly well, maybe so well that other individuals would not even be able to know that there was anything going on? Again, we're well beyond what the research of these types of medications actually show. So I can't really answer these questions, unfortunately, because there is no body of research that talks about people who can't sleep, or people who can't sleep but they take some of drug X and now they can sleep and leave a functional life. That doesn't mean those people don't exist. We see a lot of them. And this is always a difficult area for books about insomnia to address. And it brings up another question. We're going to go back to Dr. Mims. The whole reason this thing started, which is, well, Chris, what if this individual taking sleeping pills gets them to the point where they're functioning? Does it matter? And I don't know. It's a great question, meaning that this individual maybe has tried to live her life without melatonin and trazodone. I'm making this up. This is completely, we're talking about an arbitrary person at this point. They've tried CBTI, they've read a bunch of books, and they can't function without the sleeping pill or these sleeping pills. And despite the fact that there is no evidence that the pill is doing anything, there's evidence right in front of your face that's saying without it, the individual can't function. With it, they can. So what the hell do you care? What does it matter? What if they say wrapping a blue towel on my head makes me able to do X? And if I don't, you know, like, does it matter to you? You know, what is your job in this situation? And I think that's what I most struggle with. You know, I want patients to be informed, but I guess at the end of the day, I want them to lead their best life. And anyway, we'll leave this for somebody smarter to figure out. But on that note, the first study, we're going to talk about 11 studies. But before we get going, new sensation obviously was NXS's huge hit off their 1987 album Kick, actually the third single off that album. If you grew up with me, you owned that album and you loved every song on that album. That was, I think, the third concert that I went to growing up. I think it was Heart, then Whitesnake, and then NXS. And that tour was just unbelievable. I'm a huge fan of that string of albums, Shabu Shabba in 82, was their third album, blanking on their fourth album. The fifth album was Listen Like Thieves, and then Kick was 87, and just the dance or something that I can't believe I can't remember. It was the 84 album, came out 2 years after Shabu Shabba. Anyway, just an amazing string, the swing. Amazing swing string of albums, and I'm going to put out there, NXS needs to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, period, case closed, let's move on. But anyway, great song, New Sensation, Sleep Baby Sleep, Dream Baby Dream, The Sun Comes Like a God into Our Room, which will make our friend Sleepy Karin Johnson very happy because of her endless advocacy work for school start times and making sure people wake up with sun. See, even Michael Hutchins agreed with Dr. Sleepy Karn, friend of the pod. And a little known song, if you've never heard of it, the B-side to New Sensation was Do What You Do, which was, I thought it was an amazing song as well, too. And even that song references sleep. I stayed awake all last night. So one side is all about healthy sleep, sleep, baby, sleep, and sun comes like a god. Flip over to the B-side, Do What You Do is talking about staying up all night. So just with one record, you had it all. So big fan of NXS, get him in the Hall of Fame. So let's move on. First, we're going to do 11 research studies that I thought were interesting during the meeting, and a lot of other of my peers did as well too. And really excited to, if I don't feature you, doesn't mean your research wasn't out of this world. Just means I can got to keep the podcast relatively short. First one, and we'll do 11 because it'll be our reference to Spinal Tap. This one goes to 11. The typical podcast would only cover 10, but this one is going to take you to 11. So number one, decoding the determinants of subjective sleep quality in healthy adults. This was a study out of Copenhagen, looked at 25 people over an entire year. And the reason I want to start with this one is we're kind of back to our individual talking about, hey, what about people who do everything you want them to do, but they still need pills to sleep? So what we're really talking about is, hey, I'm doing everything you want me to do from a CBTI perspective, but I still have a subjective problem with the way I sleep. Again, we're going back to our definitions of insomnia we've used multiple times. And what this showed was the strongest correlate to people's satisfaction with sleep was the amount of deep sleep or N3 sleep they were getting. But REM sleep was important too, particularly the REM non-REM balance, meaning, lots of non-REM sleep, very little REM sleep, or lots of REM sleep, very little non-REM sleep. Those things tended to matter. So one of the questions I always get, from reporters or people, I'm down here in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, going to talk to all the school nurses in South Carolina. I'm looking forward to that, which is really interesting because the first school nurse talk I did was during the time I recorded episode 2, and here we are, episode 51. And so a question a lot of people ask is, what's most important, deep sleep or REM sleep? And I think this Copenhagen study really says it's all important. It's all extremely important. So moving on, number 2, sleep desert equals more dessert. And I love that because even to this day, I have to think for a minute before I spell dessert or desert. I always spelled dessert, SS, and I remember strawberry shortcake. That's how I remembered the two S's. So it's nice to see those two words in the title. Circadian misalignment predicts great food consumption in adolescence. Really, really interesting study. This was Lindsay Lee, Isabel Wright, Sarah Kamout, Kara McGee, Direccio. This was a study out of BYU. Sorry if I butchered your names. We can't all have names as boring as Chris Winter. Sorry about that. Basically looking at, the rates of adolescent obesity, something like 22%. They were following 50 healthy individuals in the study, ages 4 to 18. 58% of them were female, so pretty 50-50 split, but 94% white, which is always interesting to me because if you're seeing it in a population of 94% white people, there is a very good chance it is worse when you apply it to a mixed population or a minority population. And we're going to get to that in a study a little bit later on. So what they're showing is that when you misalign their circadian rhythm, and we talk about this a lot on this show, we talk about this a lot with school start times, that's the problem. Yeah, it's great to have sunlight when your kids get out of school so they can go to softball practice, etc. But we create circadian misalignments with daylight saving time and school start time. So when you disrupt that alignment, these kids are consuming more fat, more sugar, and more calories. And even when their sleep durations are the same, so the two populations are sleeping the same amount, but the group that's simply misaligned is causing demonstrable health harm. And once again, we go back to school start times. It doesn't, the problem with school start times, the problem with these types of misalignments is even once you've sort of quote unquote adapted to the, hour, lost an hour, gained an hour, when you're off of your circadian alignment, these problems do not go away. This is why we should all be advocating to adopt permanent standard time, get rid of daylight saving time. This study is a great example of how we pay a price for it and you don't know it. Trust me, you're not feeling that price, but the science is out there. If you live in a state where they're passing laws to adopt permanent daylight saving time, this is a great study. Pull it up out of BYU and go to whomever you need to, state senator, state congressman, or national level, and say, look, we don't want this. I don't want this for me. I don't want this for my kids. The next one, intentionally awaking from sleep and its therapeutic potential to reduce nightmares. This was great. This was written by Cami Sandel, who's a high school student at John Jay High School, the Fightin' Jays. I'm just kidding. I have no idea what their mascot is. But I love going from the idea of circadian alignment. We're hurting our kids. Here's a kid in high school doing sleep research. And what she's basically saying is, can we capitalize on lucid dreaming? We have not done an episode on lucid dreaming, but we will. It's on the list of future topics. Can we use techniques of lucid dreaming, being aware in a dream, to actually help individuals deal with nightmare disorder? In other words, when you are lucid dreaming, there's several options available to you. Number one, you become aware that you're in the dream so you can observe it. Like, okay, I'm not going to leave the dream. I'm not going to control it, but I'm just going to kind of be a bit more conscious of observing this dream, even though I'm within it. Number two, using some sort of technique to exit out of the dream. And then number three, manipulate, or what I always call dream control. Hey, I'm in the dream. Now I can change it. And she's saying, look, maybe we could use these kinds of techniques to help people with nightmare disorder. Nightmare disorder is to epilepsy what nightmare is to seizure, meaning everybody has a nightmare from time to time, maybe. But for people who have them a lot, it constitutes a nightmare disorder. So when we talk about a nightmare, it's a scary dream, bad dream in which you awaken from, a bad dream you usually don't. For people who have lots and lots of nightmares, it's a problem. You dread going to sleep because you're going to be in some sort of torturous hellscape of a dream every time you do it, or reliving a past trauma, whatever. So she was saying, look, if you have individuals practice the technique of lucid dreaming and, opening and closing their eyes over and over again, they might be able to exit out of the dream quicker or clench their fists. And what she showed was individuals who did the eye technique could actually exit from the dream 67% of the time during it while it's happening. And the majority of people outside of that 67% were able to get out of the dream very quickly during it. So shout out to Cami. Good job. Way to go. You're out there forwarding the science of sleep. And I think about myself, I was older than Cami's the one person out there who can probably say I got into sleep at a younger age than Chris. I was still a teenager, but I was early in my college career when I just stumbled into sleep research just to get some money and some credit hours and some experience. I mean, she's starting off in high school. So good for you. Welcome, Cami, to the sleep world. It's a lot of fun. Moving on, I'm going to talk about two abstracts I saw sort of together because I think they sort of tell a similar story. One was factors associated with insomnia in male university students. This was Brianna George and Sheila Garland out of Memorial University in Newfoundland. You can actually follow Sheila Garland. I think she's on Twitter. And what it was showing was that there is a lot of sleep disturbances and insomnia in the male university student population. 18% endorse significant insomnia. You see a lot of medication use. Their chronotype tends to influence that. They have reduced mindfulness and sort of techniques for dealing with the insomnia and increased psychological distress. And so what she's showing is that in this study, this is a very big unmet problem. And social media plays a huge role in these types of things. I'm going to mention very quickly, I participated in some sleep education programs for a company called Manual Care. I was paid by Manual Care to do these programs. Once I was paid and did the program, my connection financially with them is no longer. So I'm talking to you. If you go click on Manual Care or you don't, I do not financially gain one way or the other. But what attracted me to this was the guy who started, a guy named Matthew, started. He had a background, I think, with Men's Health Magazine, which I think is how we got connected. But he left and said, you know, there is an unmet need here. In smaller universities where education funds are small, and you can imagine that's something that's often cut, there are young people coming into a college environment and they don't have the necessary knowledge about sleep that they should. And Manual Care was sort of designed to basically say, look, you can log in here and learn about sleep and hygiene and all kinds of different things that maybe you've missed along the way to make yourself a smarter, healthier, more informed college student. So this study really reminded me of that. In fact, I sent it to Matthew because I thought it was really fantastic. The other study I thought linked to this was sleep, loneliness, and high-risk alcohol use in college students before and during the COVID pandemic. This was from one of my favorite sleep researchers, Roxanne Pritchard. Please follow her on Twitter. She's an absolute gem. And Caleb Cutera, I'm sorry, I can't even read my own handwriting. Caleb, I'm sorry. We'll correct it on the next episode. But basically what they were saying was sleep disturbances predispose or predict problem drinking. People who have longer sleep latencies, people who have a lot of daytime sleepiness, these are things that if you pick up on, it might lead you to understand that these individuals could or at risk for developing problem drinking. And the numbers in that study were staggering. 66% of, you know, college students had used, and this was a 50,000 student survey or something like that. 66% of them have used alcohol in the last 3 months. 13% endorsed driving while using alcohol within the last month. Among the drinkers, 24% or about a quarter of them consider themselves heavy drinkers, 22% blacking out, 7% injury, 11% unprotected sex, 2.7%, you know, suicide attempts. So this is a huge population of individuals, a huge need. And again, I just kind of think back to that Manual Care of who's educating people, where are they getting the education about these things, not only in terms of sleep, but all these sort of health-related metrics that we eventually get, hopefully. But certainly, if you could start schools off on that right foot, it would be better. And speaking of feet, the next topic, next research I saw, move your feet and sleep. A longitudinal dynamic analysis of physical activity, sedentary behavior. Insomnia symptoms. So basically it was saying, look, sedentary behavior predicted insomnia. So the more sedentary you were, the more likely you were to have insomnia. This was a big study, 755 patients. This was from Spencer Nielsen out of VCU, right down the road from where I live in Charlottesville. And what I really like about this is a great study to point to when somebody's complaining about sleep. You know, I've read the book, I've done all these things, you know, nothing helps me sleep. My first question with a lot of patients is, tell me about your exercise regimen. If y'all follow me on Instagram, and again, my social media handle, Dr. Chris Winter Instagram, Dr. Chris Winter Twitter, Dr. Chris Winter TikTok. We have a Sleep Unplugged YouTube page. You can follow me on there too. We always welcome any comments, corrections, criticisms, compliments, whatever you got, send them your way. If you follow me on Instagram, you know, I exercise a lot. I feel like it's not an option. You're going to brush your teeth. You're going to exercise. You're going to get something to eat. You're going to get something to drink. And you're going to try to make those things as good as you can make them. So I exercise a lot. I think it's the cornerstone of great sleep. And so I really, without being judgmental, listen, everybody's got their own things going on. I've gone through periods of time where I don't exercise. You know, I don't need to be judged by that. But if you're really serious about trying to improve the quality of your sleep, and you're able to exercise, I think you have to. And this is a great study that's basically saying, look, it's sort of like saying, I really want to not be hungry, but I don't want to go over to the store and buy food. What do you got for me? I got nothing. I don't know the way to keep you from getting hungry outside of eating food. And I think what Spencer would say, I'm not putting words in your mouth there, Spencer, is that, look, you know, the more sedentary you are, the more at risk you are to have sleep problems and insomnia. So let's flip it around. This is a great way to potentially find for people to move past their sleep issues with simply just being more active. So Fitbit's on your wrist. How many steps are you taking? Increase it by a couple thousand and see what happens. Thank you very much, Spencer. It's a fantastic study. I'm going to exclude sleep tech from this talk because I'm going to do an episode on that. But there's a lot of great stuff about sleep tech. Next person I'm going to highlight, Wendy Troxell. We've mentioned on this show before. She wrote the book Sharing the Covers, which I'm shocked that I remember the title because I always butcher her book's title. It's a great book. When interested in, you know, sleep, relationship, sex, there it is, Sharing the Covers. I always call it Between the Sheets or Get in Bed with Me or Let's Spend the Night Together. I got all these great euphemisms for it, but I always miss the one that's the actual. So she wrote this with Heather Gunn from Tuscaloosa. She's from Park City, Idaho. And it was basically saying, look, poor sleep hygiene among couples creates partner conflict. I love that. You know, it's, you know, take a temperature of the relationship that you have with your partner. Is it positive? Is it negative? Is it testy? Is it a lot of conflict, a lot of fights? Okay. If it's the latter, take a look at your bedroom. What's it look like? Are we eating? Sorry, I'm at a hotel. Somebody sounds like they're trying to open up the door. Sorry about that. Kind of lost my train of thought. Somebody's coming on in and I'm here by myself. So poor sleep hygiene, partner conflict. So take a look at your bedroom. Pizza boxes everywhere, television on the wall. Are you working in your bedroom as if it's your office? You know, so I think that really looking at sleep habits among a couple is really important to start a relationship off in a healthy way. I've got a family member that's getting ready to begin the next phase of her life, moving in with her partner. And this is great information, isn't it? Hey, you know, make sure you've got all the things you need and, you know, make sure you set your boundaries and, you know, but let's make sure that sleep hygiene is good with you and also with your partner, because that's a variable that we can definitely control. Thank you very much, Wendy and Heather. Next one, sleep health according to Beyonce. And they work my nerves, and that's why I can't sleep at night. That's from the song Break My Soul off of her latest album, Renaissance, her seventh album. She wrote that album, I believe, basically as sort of an escape for everybody during COVID. It was the lead single. Got nominated at the Grammys for three different awards, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, I believe. Lost both of those, but it did win Best Dance Electronic. I think a lot of people were not particularly happy about that. It's a great song and obviously an amazing artist. Rashawn Lane, PhD at Harvard, did a wonderful poster presentation looking at racism, classism and sexism and the relationships between these things and poor sleep health and quality. And, you know, looking at people who experienced discrimination occasionally on a day-to-day basis, major discriminatory acts, and showing that particularly in minority populations, particularly in Black women, this has a profound effect on sleep health and sleep quality, which is really part of a much bigger conversation that I don't know that I carry the right expertise to have of how sleep care and the distribution of sleep resources is a problem in this country. And there's real disparity between socioeconomic class. And this is, you know, I've wanted to do a podcast about why our clinic decided to go to a mainly cash pay model. We're a very small clinic, and at some point we just kind of made that decision, but it was not without a lot of thinking and stress about, are we only serving people who can afford it? And we really, you know, tried to take steps to make sure that that's not the case. But unfortunately, we live in a society where delivery of medical care and the financial compensations that go along with it create all kinds of problems, and sleep is not immune to that. So I really applaud her, Dr. Lane, for really not only making the best looking poster at the meeting, but really calling attention to it. She knows how to play the game, right? Let's make a great poster, gets everybody's attention, and create real dialogue, very important information within there. I always joke about doctors, you know, that can take the most amazing science. They've discovered a cure for this or a treatment for that, or they're groundbreaking, and they deliver the most boring, most sedating conversation lecture about it that you would ever, you know. So marrying great information and great presentation, I am all about that, Dr. Lane. Congratulations to you. Fantastic work. Number nine, is it wiser to train in the afternoon or early evening which is better in terms of the role of chronotype and adolescent and athlete? I'm sorry, so basically I asked the title is, is it better to train in the afternoon or the evening if you're a young athlete? Which one is better, and does sleep, you know, play a role in that? This was Dr. Osama Saadi. And if you're really interested in this research, you can check out Jesse Cook. He is Sleep and Sports on Twitter. He runs the Sleep Research Society's podcast. I believe this is episode 13. He did it just on this article, but I wanted to mention it here. And because it's something that I do with professional athletes. So now we're taking the professional athlete and bringing it down to the adolescent and saying, does timing matter? Exercising, training right after school or later in the evening. And what they found was that the later exercise did reduce sleep efficiency by a little less than 2%. And it did increase sleep onset latency, the time it takes to fall asleep, by about 5 minutes, a little bit less. And chronotype mattered. So if you had night owls, they were affected less by that change than the morning type. So once again, we find in sports and in school, matching the chronotype with the time when performance is expected of you definitely does matter. And again, we see that. I know that the elite athletes, the professional athletes that I'm dealing with, have been selected out. All those super morning types, I am not working with them at major league basketball training camps because that disadvantage that chronotype gives them probably matters. And we've looked at this as well too with baseball pitchers and whatnot. This was from a presentation from Terry Cunningham, Sleep Strong. Follow him on Twitter. He was all over the meeting and put some really entertaining Twitter posts up there. He, in one of his conclusion slides, he wrote some interesting things about sleep in the pandemic, which I think we're all thinking. And he said, but I'm brave enough to say it, which is great. And he said, number one, the pandemic, if there was a silver lining, showed that there was increased sleep regularity, better sleep timing, and maybe a little bit better sleep duration. We've seen that in kids. I talked about that book, The Rested Child. I think you were able to see it in school-age kids more than maybe you were seeing in the general population or in adults. Number two, the return to normalcy that we are all thankfully experiencing has come with losing some of those sleep gains, unfortunately. And this final piece, which strikes close to home for me because I work from home now since the pandemic, is sleep researchers and clinicians need to champion WFH, work from home. And I believe that entirely. And I talk to my patients all the time. Okay, tell me about your commute. It's an hour into the, can you work from home? Yeah, we can work from home, but our boss wants us to come in once a week. Listen, I'm not the boss of your company. I don't know why he or she wants you to do that, but could we get around it? Because I think you're losing time to sleep because of your commute. So this is not a forum about working from home and all the negatives that might go along with it. We're isolated. We're not around social. You know, we don't, you know, get to move our bodies through space. We're not seeing sunlight. We don't have the companionship and the, you know, the face-to-face that we used to. I'm sure all those things carry negatives. But from a sleep perspective, I think we have to very much pay attention to working from home as a way to increase sleep amount in people, which, as we know, is probably deficient over the across the boards anyway. So I appreciate Terry for having the strength and the courage to say it. Finally, number 11, and I like this one as well, too, because it goes back to sort of, you know, the working from home. We're using computers in intelligent ways rather than surfing TikTok videos at 3 o'clock in the morning. This was a study from Michelle Drup and Alicia Roth, who's the at Sleep Detective, wonderful follow and a good buddy. They wrote hybrid cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia improves success and patient engagement, showing that if people engage in CBTI through not only maybe in person, but also online or hybrid engagement, they had a quicker return for their first follow-up, which, as somebody who does a lot of CBTI, that first follow-up's important. I was just reading Jade's book, and there was a whole section of, but what if this, but what if this, but what? It was all the questions you start asking once you engage in CBTI. Like, well, wait a minute, if you're telling me to stay up later, I need to get more sleep, isn't that bad? And shouldn't I sleep in later on the week? Like, all these questions come up in that first follow-up visit. So the distance between the time you initiate and that first follow-up is very important. And what Alicia and Michelle were showing is, if you have a hybrid model, you make that better. You also increase the number of people who finish the treatment to completion. And let me tell you, that is so important. How many people do we see that say, well, I tried CBTI for a week, didn't work? It's not a week-long thing. My God, the week is the distance between starting and your first follow-up. You've got to see it through to the end. So anything that we can do to improve seeing it through to the end could make a big difference for our patients. It could make a big difference for the very first patient we talked about to open this show, who says, look, Chris, I've tried it all. It didn't work. Maybe some sort of hybrid CBTI model could have been the difference for somebody like that finding the sleep that they ultimately desire. So anyway, that's our whirlwind through APSS 2023, done and dusted. Thank you, Indianapolis. Thank you to all my friends, the ones that I saw and the ones that I missed. I really appreciate all the work you do, and it's an honor to be on here talking about it to the masses and exposing your work to them. Again, if you want to get in touch with the show, it's Dr. Chris Winter TikTok, Dr. Chris Winter Instagram, Dr. Chris Winter Twitter. Follow our page on YouTube. It's the Sleep Unplugged podcast page on YouTube, where videos of all the episodes are on there. And you can see this wonderful wall behind me here in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We'll be talking to school nurses all day tomorrow and getting them all fired up to find sleep problems in their kids and fix them quickly. That's it. Thank you all very much for tuning in. My name is Dr. Chris Winter. This is the Sleep Unplugged podcast. Until next week, sleep well.